for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Last year, NPR's Morning Edition co-host David Greene climbed aboard the historic Trans-Siberian Railway to travel across Russia. The journey from Moscow to Vladivostok covered nearly 6,000 miles. In a new book, he writes about his encounters with ordinary Russians and how their lives have been changed since the fall of the Soviet Union. He says they all struggle with the ghosts of the Soviet past, but remain ambivalent about democracy. His new book is titled Midnight in Siberia, A Train Journey into the Heart of Russia. David Greene joins me in the studio. I'm sure you'll have your own questions for him. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. David Greene, it's so good to have you here.
It is great to be here, Diane. I have to say, I've been a fan for a long time. It's great to meet you in person. When I travel around the country and talk to public radio listeners, the first question I get, have you met Diane Rehm? So now I can finally say, yes, I've met her in person. So,
have a big hug for you.
Yes, thanks for having
me. Now, I must say, people do think of you as Morning Edition co-host, but may not know you were Moscow bureau chief for 4 years. Tell us about deciding to take that position.
Wow. I had covered the White House 4 years for the Baltimore Sun and then 4 years for NPR with Don Gagne. It was 8 years covering George W. Bush. And you finish a stint like that and you sort of, you're so used to a certain kind of journalism that you step back and you kind of have to figure out what you want to do with yourself. And I had always wanted to take a try at being a foreign correspondent. People who had done it had said that it's just the greatest job in the world. And my wife, Rose, and I had a lot of, really tough conversations about whether we wanted to, take this adventure together. She was in a successful career in policy for New York City Council, and she would have to give it up and move to Russia. She's wanderlust like I do, but it was asking a lot of her, and it was sort of taking a dive together into the unknown as a couple. So it was really difficult, and it was a difficult few years. Moscow is a hard place to live, but journalistically, God, I had the entire former Soviet Union to cover, and NPR's international desk. You get deployed not just in your region, but all around the world. So from Moscow, I went to cover the Arab Spring. I was in Tunisia and Libya. I was sent to London to cover the royal wedding. So it was a great, great few years, and it was really a privilege to get to know so many Russians and to really begin to understand that story, because you have to stress begin because it's a hard story to really understand.
Tell me what your wife did during that period.
Well, she did a lot. She volunteered a lot. She worked with the American Women's Organization. She traveled a ton. And in fact, these travels that she did and that we did together have led to her second career. She now owns a restaurant in Washington and serves international street food and has I'm really, really proud of her. She has pulled off something amazing, done it, pretty much by herself. It's a lot of the foods that we tasted together, and really the travels we did were the inspiration, which it's wonderful.
What about housing?
In Moscow, it's interesting because we lived, and NPR has the apartment and office in a place that's nicknamed Sad Sam for Sadovaya Samotochnaya.
I was going to ask whether you spoke Russian.
Yeah, just
clearly.
A little bit. Chut-chut, which means just a tiny bit. But I picked up a nice bit. So it's a journalism compound. And back in Soviet times, a lot of news organizations, Western news organizations, were sort of confined there by the Soviet government. They didn't have a choice. But over the years, it became such a wonderful journalism community that even after the fall of the Soviet Union, news organizations now could go anywhere, have your bureaus anywhere. But NPR, the New York Times, and some others have decided to just stay in this place. And we think it's probably still bugged since it's owned by the government, but It's a great place, but I'll say, Diane, the sad thing that you see now is it used to be, you know, 80-90% news organizations, and so many newspapers and news outlets have been closing foreign bureaus. You just feel it there because now, you know, the number of journalists, you know, it's really dwindling, and you see Russian businesses opening, and so it's a microcosm for what I think we're seeing in journalism. You know, you're just fewer and fewer organizations are deploying abroad.
So, during those years as Moscow bureau chief, what stood out for you the most?
I think one thing that stood out to me was that to even try and understand this country, you really had to get out of Moscow. You know, Moscow's so important. It's the center of Russian power today. It is becoming an international city in its own strange, uncomfortable way. It's not that inviting to tourists, but it's beautiful. It's vibrant. It's frustrating. It's just a place full of life in good ways and bad ways. So it's a wonderful place to live and experience. But, you know, when you see, and I'm thinking of December 2011, when you see protests against Vladimir Putin in Moscow, that's a huge thing. For Russians to go out on the streets and protest the government, it takes courage, it's risky, and for thousands of people to be there, it's a big deal. But there's a tendency, I think, sometimes to think that the story you're seeing unfold in Moscow is telling you the story of Russia. And it's just really important to remind yourself that it is a totally different landscape once you get out there. And that's one thing that I think people who cover Russia, you know, have to remind themselves all the time, that it's a big country with it's a vast, vast space. And the story of Moscow is not the story of Russia.
And for most of us, I think that 6,000-mile journey on the express, we've only seen it in Dr. Zhivago on film. And you saw it firsthand.
Yeah, it was something I always wanted to do. And as I was wrapping up the time as Moscow correspondent, I was sort of talking with editors about whether that was the moment to do it and to just sort of say to our listeners, you know, we've been following Russia. I've been following Russia for the last few years. Seems like an interesting time. Let's jump aboard the train. Let's listen to voices. And I didn't know when we were planning the trip that it would be the time when these protests against Putin would be erupting in Moscow. And it was funny. We'd have these conversations while I was on the train about whether I was in the wrong place, because here I am covering Russia for NPR and these protests are happening and I'm 2,000 miles to the east in some remote section of Siberia, and there were some editors who were like, should we get David back there, maybe get him on a plane somewhere? But I think we came to the conclusion that I was in the right place, because capturing the country more as a whole and not just focused on the capital.
But what was it that put you over the edge and said, I really want to do this train trip?
Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you, as kind of a lover of travel, I mean, it's one of the romantic, exotic trips in the world. I don't know if there are many, if any at all, that you could put on top of that list for me. It just seemed like the kind of thing that I would just love to tell my kids and grandkids. You know, I did the Trans-Siberian Railway, which is just kind of crazy. But I also saw it as a way to see all of Russia. I mean, if you think about it, it's so vast. The communities, especially once you get into Siberia, are so remote and far from each other. You kind of wonder what holds the country together. Mm. And if you think of Russia as kind of a body, I mean, the Trans-Siberian is sort of the spine. And it's a way to sort of travel along and see the place as a whole and to kind of grasp its vastness and to get a sense for the complexity and the variety of people and cultures and ethnicities.
Tell me about the people on the train itself.
It varied and it depended on which class of service we were on. So some people, when you think about the Trans-Siberian, you imagine trains that literally go these 6,000 miles from Moscow to Vladivostok. And absolutely, some of the trains do that. But when you're stopping and getting off, as we did, you know, you might be on a train for 12 or 14 hours that's actually only traveling 2 days from one city to another.
I see.
And so it depends what train you're on. You might meet people who are just traveling sort of 5 or 6 hours, or you might find someone who is traveling across the entire country. And I think if you're in sort of first class or second class, they're closed cabins. You might have a cabin on your own. You might have a cabin for four. So you and a friend might be sharing it with two strangers. And those might be, you know, people who work for energy companies, or they might be doctors or lawyers who are paying a little bit more money to go across. Third class, it's kind of like a college dormitory. Imagine an open car with just a bunch of bunks, and you're walking down the aisle, and to your right, there's a table that becomes a bunk, and then another bunk above that one. And to your left, there are four bunks that are perpendicular to the window, two and two. And that class of service could have anyone. Families who couldn't afford to see other family members who live, you know, 3,000 miles away, and they're taking a trip for the first time to see them in years, and they've gone shopping in Moscow, and they have these bags to bring to their family when they get there. It might be people coming up from Central Asia who don't even speak Russian but are looking for construction work throughout Russia, and they're traveling along the train. So it's a real mix. And you get to know people, and not necessarily talking to them. I mean, right. You get to know them by hearing their snores and, you know, seeing them change to go to bed. And you are in this space, and you have to get used to certain rituals. I mean, if Diane, if you're on the bottom bunk and I have the top bunk, I need to, you know, almost step on you sometimes to get up to my bunk to go to bed.
David Green, he is co-host of Morning Edition, author of a brand new book, Midnight in Siberia. Your calls, your comments when we come back. Stay with us. And welcome back. If you've just joined us, NPR Morning Edition host David Green is with me. He's written a new book all about his train journey into the heart of Russia. It's called Midnight in Siberia. He spent 4 years as Moscow bureau chief for NPR and then decided he needed to take this train trip across into the heart of Russia. And for those of you who'd like to see a map of David's trip across Russia, some pictures from the people he met along the way, you can go to our website, drshow.org. Some glorious photographs there and a wonderful slideshow. You said, David, that Russians are some of the warmest people on Earth. That could come as something of a surprise to many Americans. Do you think they're misunderstood, or do we simply not see them where they are comfortable?
Probably mostly the latter, because I think, from everything I know about Soviet times, people describe it as a place where it wasn't very comfortable out on the streets and in public. There was a sense of, why do anything? Why interact? Why talk to the police? Why do anything that might draw attention to myself? And so I think there was this tendency to look inward and to sort of put a straight face or a sort of cold face on yourself when you were out in public, and then just get home to the confines of where you live. And I feel like that style is sort of still there. I mean, you talk to Russians who come to the United States and they'll say, "Why do you Americans smile so much?" Which is really funny.
Yeah.
On the flip side, you know, as an American, as soon as you arrive, you know, it just feels so cold and unwelcoming on the sidewalks. You know, people just walk by you. No one will get out of your way, or they'll sort of run into you on the sidewalk as if, you know, this piece of human flesh is in their way and they just want to push it out of the way. I mean, there's just no natural interaction. But as soon as you get to know a family or someone, you know, they bring you into their apartments or their homes. There are these traditions that are beautiful. You know, you take off your shoes and they might have slippers ready for you. They offer you tea or maybe vodka or cognac, which can be the scary thing to hear.
Yeah.
But you just relax and you feel so at home so quickly once someone welcomes you in.
You know, I have been to Russia a few times, and on one occasion we were invited into an apartment belonging to a resident. She must have put out a week's worth of food.
A spread, I would imagine.
To enjoy. Just incredibly warm and kind and sharing her life. And yet, now I happen to live right down the street from the Russian embassy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are Russian people walking back and forth with their children. They rarely make eye contact.
There you go. No, so I think you captured it perfectly. That's exactly what living in Moscow was like.
Two different kinds of interactions. But you managed to find your way through.
Yeah, and it was, you sort of developed, it was developing trust. And once you develop that trust, you know, it would happen. I mean, one of the first experiences I had, and often it was, you know, if someone trusted you, they might bring you into, you know, their world, so to speak. And Sergei Sotnikov, he is dear friend. He's the Moscow producer for NPR, an amazing journalist. And in many ways, I saw Russia through his eyes, producer, interpreter, and friend. One of the first trips we did together was to Eastern Ukraine, the Russian-speaking part of Ukraine. Sergei grew up in Donetsk, and he took me to his father's house. And, you know, it was this neighborhood that was, it was rough, it was snow-covered, it was dirt roads, it was kind of dilapidated homes, it was a coal miner's community. People, you know, had it really tough. And he brings me into his father's house, and it's the spread of food you're talking about. As soon as we walked in, it's 7:30 in the morning. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, breakfast. It was a breakfast, massive buffet on the table with everything hot, cold, and then one shot of cognac or vodka after another at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And I just felt at home so quickly.
But, you know, here in this country, we talk about the 1% and the 99% is the same exactly across Russia.
I think so. I don't know the exact numbers, but the amount of wealth that is concentrated is stunning. I mean, you think about oligarchs and these Russians who were able to capitalize at the end of Soviet times. And I mean, they have so much money. And I think that is one of the untold stories of Russia today, that a lot of what we're seeing when it comes to Russian policy, you can't forget that there's money tied up in it, and that there are, you know, people who are close to Putin or not who might benefit or might not when you're talking about energy and other things. And it's a hard, hard story to dig into, because those are the stories that get Russian journalists in big trouble. And then you look out in the villages and across Russia, and it's very impoverished. But I will say Russians in general have done better under Vladimir Putin. And that is one of the things you don't hear much of. I mean, in general, you know, Russians have done better over Putin's time. And that's not something to lose sight of or forget as we sort of wonder where Putin's popularity comes from.
Yeah. So therefore, they're very uncertain about the idea of a democratic form of government. They're happy with for the most part, Putin as is?
For the most part, I mean, there's growing opposition to Putin in the country, and that's a big question going forward. But, you know, Putin's poll numbers and polling is really tough in Russia. It's hard to say it's reliable, but it looks like he's, you know, in the 70-80% range, which, you know, and the annexation, the forced annexation of Crimea, which, you know, a lot of the West doesn't recognize, made Putin enormously popular. And this is, you know, Diane, you look back at sort of the tradition of Russian culture. I mean, back through Tsarist times, there was this idea that if you're Russian and it's a dangerous world out there, if you give yourself to the Tsar, he will protect you. And that legacy, in a modern way, still exists today. And it's really unbelievable that kind of culture and history matters so much, but it really does.
So how do they talk about Putin?
They talk about Putin and, you know, it's funny. There's one young man who stands out to me. His name's Ivan, and I met him near Chelyabinsk, which was the city where the meteorite fell out of the sky, which was one of those bizarre Russian stories. And I was actually looking to collect a souvenir. I wanted a space, chunk of space debris. I'm a Star Wars nut. I thought that was really cool. And so I met him, and we decided to go to a cafe together the next morning. And Ivan, as a kid, lost both his parents and got to the point, I mean, he was trying to get by himself with the help of neighbors and people in the community. He had to do his mandatory year in military service. And he asked the government if he could not do it, if they would let him out because he was orphaned. And they said, absolutely not. You have to do it. It sounds torturous. I mean, Russian military training is so incredibly brutal. I mean, they literally tear you apart and put you back together again. And this young man is sitting there and telling me that he's so happy he went through this because he feels like it made him Russian. It made him strong. It made him able to endure. And, you know, he cried at one point as we're sitting there, you know, sipping tea. And he just said, I love my country and I feel like the sense of community and the protection I feel in my village is so important. And I challenged him. I said, you know, Ivan, what do you dream about? And he said, I'd love to own a business sometime. I have enough money to buy a truck and run some sort of delivery business or something. I said, well, you know, you're going to do it. I don't think I'll ever have the money to do that. Huh. But I feel like I have my friends here. And, you know, his relationship with Putin, I mean, it's just he felt like that protection that he felt in his village and community. That kind of protection was what he was getting from the top. And it's just this, it goes back through generations in Russia. I think there's just a feeling of the world out there can be very scary. And when we hear things like, you know, these arguments that the West and the fascists are doing terrible things in Ukraine and a lot of the propaganda right now in Russia, I think it resonates with people and they feel a sense of fear and uncertainty in the rest of the world.
Do you think women feel the same way men do?
God, that's a really good question. I mean, the story of women in Russia is extraordinary. I think, you know, I don't think there's this marked difference politically when you talk to men or women. I think women also, you know, a lot of them take pride in their strength. I think
they were among the first doctors. They
absolutely.
Professionals.
And this goes back to World War II times when many men died, fighting in World War II. And so women have always taken pride in going about it alone and kind of being the lifeblood of the country. And you see that still today. I mean, the life expectancy for men because of alcoholism, because of just, you know, tough living and tough work, it barely got over 60 recently. I mean, it was in the upper 50s for a good number of years. So you meet a lot of women, babushkas, who, you know, are living life on their own without a man. And they are tough. You don't want to mess with a babushka in the streets of Moscow or anywhere in Russia because they really are, you know, especially the older generation, they really keep the country, you know, they're the engine in a way.
You know, I think we also should mention you have family roots in Russia.
I do. It's funny. Some Russian, some Latvian. and also some Ukrainian. I was in Western Ukraine in the city of Lviv, which is very beautiful, very European. Fell in love with the city. And I was speaking to my father one day, and I said, you know, I was in Lviv. And he said, oh, that's the city where our family roots are. You know, that's the Polish city where our family's from. And I said, well, it's actually Ukrainian, Dad. And he was like, well, I mean, you know, our borders have changed so much. But it turns out, you know, I have Ukrainian blood as well, if we consider that part of Ukraine, which, you know, it's really cool.
And your mother?
My mother is the Latvian side. And going to Riga, you know, I had to make some trips to the Baltics when I was covering that. I felt a connection there as well. The research I've done is my family left at the end of the 19th century from Latvia, and they were on their way to New York, and the boat stopped in Cork in Ireland, and they screamed out, you know, they screamed out Cork, but a lot of Latvians thought they had heard New York, and they all got out. So I had family in Dublin for 10, 20 years.
David Greene, co-host of NPR's Morning Edition, his new book, Midnight in Siberia, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. David, you mentioned the babushkas, and I know we have some music from them.
Oh, great.
Tell us about this.
So this is a group of singing babushkas from the village of Baranova. Russia has a lot of little pockets of ethnicities, and they are Udmurt, which is, you know, they have a distinct language, which they weren't really able to speak during Soviet times because different languages and different religions weren't really encouraged, shall we say. These women began a singing group together, singing in their native Udmurt language.
How many?
There are probably about a dozen of them total. And they made sort of international fame because they had YouTube videos and they did some Beatles covers. And they just started singing and got a lot of attention.
These women are, David.
I get chills listening to them. They're 60s, 70s. I think one was over 80.
Wow.
Yeah, they started singing, and they wanted to raise money to rebuild the church, the Orthodox church in their village, Baranova. And they just started getting attention, so much so that they represented Russia at the big international Eurovision contest. And they were an absolute hit. And I think that's the tape we were hearing right there. And you just can't imagine these wonderful, brilliant, adorable women in their native Udmurt outfits on stage. They're so, so inspiring and have had such rough lives. It was exactly what we were talking about. Many of them had lost their husbands and sort of turned to this singing group for friendship and to sort of get by together. They're just the time I spent with them, I just felt so honored to hang out
with
them.
You know, you mentioned they raised money for their Orthodox church. Did you, on your travels, infer the kind of religious discord between those who were Orthodox and those who did not believe?
Yeah, I think there's some people in Russia who are deeply, deeply religious. There's some who just, you know, they'll have Orthodox icons hanging on their dashboard or from their rearview mirror. And so, you know, I think religion gives them, you know, a feeling of support, you know, to get by in the day, but they're not that religious. But there are people who, you know, aren't that religious at all. And I think it comes from living through Soviet times, perhaps, and a time when religion wasn't encouraged and a lot of Orthodox.
But do they ever look askance at each other?
I never got the sense
of
religious tension.
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't there. And you know, Orthodox churches are
gorgeous.
They're absolutely gorgeous. Some people who are more cynical, you know, journalists and Westerners will say, I've finally gotten sick of going to an Orthodox church, because you go to one after another in every city you go to. I never got sick of it. And you'd always go in, there'd be a different style of icons all over the walls, and there would be people who would bring you in and candles, and, you know, it was something really special.
Absolutely beautiful. David Greene, he's co-host of NPR's Morning Edition, and he's written a new book. It's got a great cover, called Midnight in Siberia, A Train Journey into the Heart of Russia. Going to take a short break now. When we come back, it's time to open the phones, read your email. I look forward to speaking with you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Unisys Corporation, maker of Unisys Stealth cybersecurity software. You can't hack what you can't see. Learn more at unisys.com/stealth. By the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is a tribute to NPR's ongoing dedication to music and the arts. By the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
Popularity is the slutty little cousin of prestige, my friend.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Edward Norton about co-starring in the new film Birdman as a gifted but pretentious and self-absorbed actor. Norton's other films include Moonrise Kingdom, The Grand Budapest Hotel, The 25th Hour, and Fight Club. Join us.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, David Greene, who is co-host of NPR's Morning Edition, is here in the studio with me. He's written a new book all about his 6,000-mile train journey into the heart of Russia. The book is titled Midnight in Siberia. Here's an email from Mark. He says, Russia has over 80 republics and regions, many of which have non-Russian indigenous populations. Has Putin exposed its own multifaceted federation to the risk of secessionist sentiment with his Ukrainian adventure of stoking Russian separatists in the Ukraine?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, Russia is full of different republics and ethnicities. I mean, the Udmurt Republic that we talked about earlier, Diane, it's where these babushkas come from. I don't know. I mean, I wonder what the reaction is going to be to what's happened in eastern Ukraine. There was an outpouring of patriotism after
and support
for Crimea.
Yeah.
I mean, and Russians felt a real deep connection to Crimea. But there's been chatter and some polls suggesting that support for eastern Ukraine has been much less so. And what we've seen has been this sort of very powerful, terrible story where the Kremlin has denied actually having deployed officially Russian troops into eastern Ukraine. But you had these journalists who were going and finding families who had lost sons who were deployed, it appeared, to eastern Ukraine. And, you know, one hypothesis is that the Kremlin is really sensitive about this because they don't know if Russians are willing to sacrifice for eastern Ukraine, if, you know, they don't know whether they believe in that cause. Now, whether the idea of sort of republics being separatist, I'm not sure. I will say, you know, it's one of the things in Russian politics, Putin's party, the United Russia Party, he's really taken firm control over the regions as best he can. And so you have prosecutors, you have city officials who, you know, are literally tied to him politically and bureaucratically. So it's his presence is everywhere. And there's a feeling that he has, you know, that division is actually Putin's strategy of avoiding some sort of large-scale opposition movement. Because if you keep people feeling divided, it's hard for an opposition movement to come together. But it's a Mark, it's a really interesting question to explore.
Here's a tweet from Stan. Can you please have David talk more about the Russian countryside and the people and less about politics? My fault.
It's both our faults, Diane.
Go ahead.
The Russian countryside is gorgeous. Lake Baikal is this stunning, stunning place in the Far East. It's considered the sister lake of Lake Tahoe. They look similar. I would argue that Lake Baikal is even more beautiful.
Really?
This place is visually stunning. It's this huge, huge, deep, deep water lake with mountains that just rise on all sides. And the lake freezes during the wintertime. And you can walk across it. You can ride bicycles across it. They literally form snow roads across it. And you can take a hovercraft across it, which Sergey and I did. We hired a hovercraft, and I was expecting some sort of high-tech hovercraft. This was like a Russian Lada stuck on top of a pontoon. It was just bizarre, and I thought that this is the way Sergey and I were going to go. We were going to crash through the ice. But it's just that the ice on Lake Baikal, it freezes, and when it's not snow-covered, it's like this sort of green cracked glass that just shimmers in the sunlight. It's beautiful, and then it becomes snow-covered, and it's just a snowy landscape, and it is one of the most stunning places I've ever seen in my life.
All right, let's go to Torrance, California. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi. Hey, that was a great show. I'm fascinated by listening to this.
Good.
In fact, I actually drove with my 19-year-old daughter from Vladivostok to Sochi back in 2008.
It's a long trip.
It was a long trip. It was a fascinating trip, though. So I had to have, like, a boots on the ground. So I really wanted to visit that place. When I saw that Dr. Zhivago, I thought, wow, that place to be. So we drove from Vladivostok all the way to Sochi. And I went through some villages, and we noticed that those villages, like civilization, hasn't touched for hundreds of years. I mean, when we saw, we got lost so many times, so we ended up in the village. People would just come straight to us, some of them scary looking, some of them totally curious what we were doing over there. And I had Arizona number plate, so they thought it was just a kind of decal. They didn't know that it was American car. But, we had a lot of good time with the local people, but not so good time with the police. I mean, we ended up putting a lot of bribes, and we got in a jail a few times.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. We got stuck in the Lada car, and they would not let us go. They would start bargaining with us for, like, 1,000 euros, and we put them over. The moment they see American passport, you are done.
That's interesting. Once they see an American passport.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting, and that can, I felt like that helped sometimes in reporting. Yeah. But the police and the spending time in jail, that's really frightening.
Now, here's what I want to ask you. In talking with people, I know you had a translator with you, but how did you approach people? Why would they want to talk to you? Why would they trust you and not fear that perhaps you had some ulterior American motive?
I ask this question to myself all the time. I mean, when I do journalism in the United States, I sometimes wonder why people talk to me, because I'm thinking, if a journalist came up to me and started asking me about my life, would I just start, you know, pouring out facts and my history and my emotions? And so I'm grateful all the time when people will talk to me. In Russia, the rate of people talking probably was even higher than in the United States.
Yeah. Over heaven's sake.
And I would just, Diane, I don't know. I think Russians are, because of the Soviet education system, they are on average so educated and so sort of knowledgeable, rich, poor, no matter where, what part of the country you're in. I mean, it would just be stunning. I remember being in this village and meeting this woman who was scared that this mill was going to close in town. She was, she was screaming out, "Food, food, food. We need food. That's why this mill can't close, because it provides jobs." Incredibly poor, dressed almost in rags, I would say. I mean, just someone who we started chatting, and the thing that stunned me, she asked where I'm from, and I said I'm from NPR, and she said, "Well, help me understand what that is." And my colleague Sergey said, "Well, it's like the BBC." She had listened to the BBC service, and had heard, knew exactly where I was coming from, got that we were radio journalists for, a national network in the United States, and just started chatting with us, and was as curious about me and my life as I was about her. And that's probably what the window was often, their own curiosity.
And we often hear that Russians turn to alcohol out of despair. Did you find that?
I did. And it's sad. There was in the city of Krasnoyarsk, one of the chapters in the book is named after a taxi driver who drove us all around. And he was telling me about, he's just scared of his country today. He's scared of Putin. He's scared of having a president who is a KGB spy. He didn't want to give me his name at the end. And then as I'm getting out of the cab, he said, "You know what? I'll give you my name. Let the world know who I am," which was huge. But we were driving and we stopped at this overlook, and Krasnoyarsk is this unbelievably gorgeous city. It's just beautiful. Chekhov called it the most beautiful city in Siberia. And we stopped over, and there was this overlook where there were wedding pictures being taken. And I remember Rose was on this part of the trip with me, and she and I were watching these couples just, and I have a picture of it that I took, and it's so memorable. Standing there taking pictures, laughing and smiling and enjoying life. It was all the best of Russia. And I got back in the taxi cab and I said to the driver, I was like, "God, I feel this joy and this happiness." And he said, "Well, it's not like that most days. And to make it as much like that as possible, we just drink to forget about, the unhappiness." And that was sad. I mean, that was sad. And I could tell that he did it. I think it's a way of escaping,
the other side.
Yeah.
And how some people cope, and certainly the same is true in this country, but that is the reputation that we in this country think belongs with the Russians. David Green is with me. His new book titled Midnight in Siberia, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's take another call, this time from John in Texas City, Texas. Hi there.
Can you all hear me?
Yes, go right ahead, sir.
Okay. I like the title of the book. That's really enchanting. Great title, whoever thought of it.
Thank you.
Part of your story on the train inspired me, because I know most people, including myself, most people love the idea of train travel. We love Amtrak, in spite of what some Republicans try to do to it every year, every funding, defunding. You inspired me for this idea of we should take part of that, the UN budget, and use that to bolster Amtrak and encourage diplomats from other countries to get together on board an Amtrak train and do some train travel across the country, not just here, but across Europe and in Russia. I think people will find really soon that people are exactly alike, no matter what part of the globe they're from.
Good call.
The train is a place where you really do meet people and feel that connection. And John, I've got to say, getting on Amtrak is now so boring to me after experiencing the Trans-Siberian. So I wish we had some more of that feeling here.
And let's take a call from Janine. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Janine from San Antonio. And David, I've been wondering where you've been, and now I know.
Now you know.
I'm right here, Janine. I'm right here.
I missed you on Morning Edition.
Oh, so thank you. I appreciate
that. I thought
that.
There might be a work in progress. So, and I also have to just tell you that we're in the middle of a fun drive, and I'm supposed to be someplace. And when I heard you on the radio, I said, I'm going to be late because I'm going to sit through the phone drive and just so I can listen to your show. So anyhow, could you talk a little bit about your going through Siberia and the people and the scenery there?
Yeah, I mean, Siberia is just, it's a different place. And I'll tell you what really felt different to me, it just feels this spirit of freedom. All is relative, of course. Yeah.
And when that's the place everybody thinks of as this huge prison.
Yeah, that's where you were sent and you were imprisoned. And what's funny is there's this legacy of the Decembrists. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but the Decembrists carried out a revolution against the Tsar. And this is going back, a couple centuries in Russian history. It failed. They were exiled to Siberia. Their wives all came along with them, and they served time in prison camps. And afterwards, a lot of them settled in Siberia. They were well-educated. They were part of, some of them were princes. And they sort of set the tone out in Siberia for being educated, a little bit of, a revolutionary spirit. They encouraged the arts. They were, they were living there. And that legacy has kind of continued. So it has this sort of Western frontier Colorado kind of feel if you're in a city like Irkutsk near Lake Baikal. But that legacy of the Decembrists sort of lives on. And you talk to people, and it's not like they're ready to go out and fight their government. But there's a feeling of, we're out here, we can sort of do our thing, live our lives. Yes, all of our government officials are tied to United Russia, Putin's party. But it feels so far away from Moscow.
Huh.
You're near China. You're near North Korea. You're near the Sea of Japan. Once you get really far out there, the distance from Moscow, it's not just a physical distance. You can sort of feel it in how people live.
And I think of Siberia as nothing but cold and ice and frigid.
Oh, that's all there.
It's all there.
It's all there.
But what about green? Is there any green?
Oh, yeah. And Siberia, we should say, is enormous. I mean, it's bigger than the United States. It is huge. And so it's hard to generalize about Siberia. There are mountains, there are forests, there are flat plateaus. There's cold, and there's really, really, really unbelievably oppressively cold. And in the summertime, it can actually get hot and bug infested. And so a lot of people say that Siberia is a lot more pleasant in the winter, which is amazing to even consider. But there's this, the rivers actually run north in a lot of parts of Siberia, which doesn't sound all that interesting until you consider that they bump up against the ice in the north. And so you get, during the summertime, these kind of swamps that have all sorts of insects and mosquitoes, and the bug problem in lots of Siberia is just awful in the summertime. So
what about young people in Siberia?
They're there, and there are a lot of large cities. And so even when you have villages that are losing their younger population, it's not like everyone's going to Moscow. They might be going to Irkutsk or Vladivostok and living lives and doing business and doing well for themselves.
David Green, he's going to be back on Morning Edition soon, but he's just finished this great book called Midnight in Siberia. Congratulations, David.
Thank you, Diana. Thanks for having me. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, lovely to have you here. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Viking River Cruises.